Hello, and welcome to Harper's Magazine on Sun Sons of Arizona. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Ellen Ward. Today I'll begin reading from the April 2025 issue. First up is an essay titled Going Soft, Future-Proofing the American Worker, by Lily Sherless. I am sitting in a bland conference room in Midtown Manhattan with 29 so-called business professionals, and one of our instructors, Sharon, has just told us to imagine a huge rectangular brass nameplate as if walking us through a guided meditation. In front of that nameplate is a huge picket fence, and behind that nameplate is a huge white house, she says. Through the windows of that house, I can see a family. They're playing. They're having fun. There's a chimney. And what is sticking out of that chimney? Several people suggest smoke. Santa Claus? Asks an employee of the Mediterranean Shipping Company, which transports hazardous goods. No, says Sharon, a huge yellow work glove. We grow confused. I imagine few of us have worn work gloves in our lives. Sharon continues. There's something interesting that glove is holding, she says. It's an airplane. This is not a normal airplane. Instead of your normal propellers, there are some things that are not normally there. There are tennis rackets, and there's actually newspaper at the center of those tennis rackets. We stare at her blankly. This is a Dale Carnegie course, a 3-day intensive designed to equip us with people skills for use in personal and professional settings. Sharon's surrealist sculpture, it turns out, is a mnemonic device for Carnegie's components of a real strong conversation, as another facilitator, Andre, later says. To put the image to use, you ask your interlocutor their name, the nameplate, and then about their family, the house, and their job, the glove. After that, you can move on to travel plans, the plane, followed by hobbies, the tennis rackets, and finally, current events. You gotta be careful, Andre notes about this last topic. Right now, it's a little politically charged. All 30 of us get on our feet to test drive the script in order to make it a skill, as Andre puts it. Giving structure to aimless chatter, we are to understand, will make for conversations with measurable outcomes. After discovering that my conversation partner works for a nonprofit funded by a family of billionaires, I tried to sleuth out exactly what his organization does, but in doing so, failed to move on from the yellow work glove stage to the airplane stage. Afterward, he tells me that I have done a good job of implementing principle number 4, become genuinely interested in other people, but that by pelting him with questions, I have prevented him from learning about me. I consider pointing out that he has achieved mastery of principle number 3, arouse in the other person an eager want. Different versions of this course have existed since Dale Carnegie, the author of How to Win Friends and Influence People and the de facto founder of the professional training industry in America, first taught it himself in 1912, the year he founded the Dale Carnegie Company. In 2020, it claimed that 4/5 of the Fortune 500 were clients of its development courses. Warren Buffett has said that one such course changed his life. In my session, my classmates include employees of Google, the United Nations Federal Credit Union, the office of the New York State Attorney General, a hedge fund, and a company that puts special sleeves in gas pipelines to extend their lives by 100 years. Over the next 2 days, we would draw vision landscapes on flip charts while a Dua Lipa song played in the background, give speeches on our life's defining moment in front of an enormous screen showing a slide reading increasing self-confidence, and learn an elaborate name game called memory pegging, which involves at least 4 different acronyms. This is the DNA, the holy grail, says Andre. If you master the art of people skills, oh my goodness, he sighs, the world is like an oyster. We are reassured that by the end of the course, we will know how to strengthen our relationships the right way. These days, courses like this are in particularly high demand on account of a purported white-collar deficit of soft skills, the non-specialized interpersonal aspect of one's professional life. Employers face a soft skills crisis, announced Personnel Today in September. Is marketing facing a soft skills crisis? Asked Marketing Week last April. The world is facing a soft skills crisis as home working leaves millions of workers struggling to interact with colleagues, the Telegraph of London reported. This crisis seems to be everywhere at once, now that soft skills are more in demand than ever, as one Forbes headline put it. Management scientists worry about the discrepancy between employer demand and workforce supply of soft skills, making the charm shortage sound like an urgent supply chain disruption. The reports read as if executives might wander into the growing skill gap and fall to their deaths. News coverage suggests that workers everywhere have yet to recover from the isolating effects of the pandemic. Socializing, we are told, is a matter of fitness. Utilizing those skills is almost like a muscle. If you're not using that muscle, it can become weak, the founder of the Swan School of Protocol, a corporate etiquette school, told the Los Angeles Times. The COVID-19 pandemic has quickly and dramatically accelerated the need for new workforce skills, the firm McKinsey & Company claimed in its global survey on reskilling. The most important skills to develop tend to be social and emotional in nature. Now that pandemic-era college students have entered the workforce, the problem has only intensified. The accounting and consulting firm KPMG is trying to rehabilitate lockdown-damaged Gen Z recruits, wrote the Telegraph, as if Zoom had denatured their brains. Unfortunately, the soft skills crisis might be part of a bigger problem, the so-called loneliness epidemic, or what The Atlantic has called the antisocial century, has driven people to the lowest recorded levels of in-person socializing in our country's history. Companies often try to solve this issue by hiring organizations like Dale Carnegie, Swan, Franklin Covey, or the American Academy of Etiquette to swoop in and conduct training courses, or to subscribe employees to asynchronous online skills marketplaces where they can complete bite-sized training modules. According to a 2023 Resume Builder survey of business leaders, more than 6 in 10 companies claimed they would send their workers to etiquette courses in 2024. Entrepreneurs are sensing an opportunity for innovation. The software development company Sozo Labs offers virtual role play training, allowing employees to practice soft skills without interacting with actual people. McKinsey, too, guides companies through skill transformations, though I'm not sure I would choose to learn empathy skills from the company that optimized ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. For a smattering of the other Dale Carnegie attendees, participation is not voluntary. They have been sent by their bosses, and Andre tells me privately that, for some, their job depends on it. I imagine that a few of my classmates have behaved in ways that flagged an urgent need for remedial training. Having been in a few meetings myself, I can also understand why some managers would want to pay an expert to file down the ragged edges of obtrusive personalities. If I had employees, I too would probably want to like them. But the claims made for soft skills go far beyond fostering a friendlier work environment. In management science, they have been cited as a remedy for everything from the mental health epidemic to AI-driven job losses, from generational obsolescence to shifts in the balance of geopolitical power. The idea that our human connections have atrophied over the past few years is by no means entirely wrong, but this isn't the first time that soft skills have been proposed as a solution to a range of American problems. Over the past century, the discourse of soft skills has repeatedly been invoked in response to technological and social upheaval. What, if anything, distinguishes our current crisis, and whom do soft skills really serve? Soft skills researchers have themselves been mired in their own long crisis. None of them have convincingly determined what a soft skill even is, despite decades of research. There is still lack of consensus regarding the definitions, a team of management scientists wrote in a 2022 article entitled, Soft Skills, Do We Know What We Are Talking About? Social scientists patched together definitions from an inconsistent taxonomy of subskills, communication skills, interpersonal skills, empathy, emotional intelligence, problem-solving skills, teamwork and collaboration, critical thinking, flexibility, creativity, leadership, and social influence, resilience, adaptability. One group of management researchers attempted to connect the dots in 2023, writing that these skills are non-technical and non-reliant on abstract reasoning involving interpersonal and intrapersonal abilities to facilitate mastered performance in particular social contexts. USAID researchers once inventoried a whopping 74 different metrics for measuring soft skills. They found that the most common parameter was self-control. A recent spate of popular books also struggles with definitions. Daniel Goleman and Carrie Sheerness's Optimal, How to Sustain Personal and Organizational Excellence Every Day, 2024, dedicates a section to explaining how soft skills are examples of emotional intelligence by another name, only to then describe emotional intelligence as a skill set. The New York Times columnist David Brooks in How to Know a Person, The Art of Seeing Others Deeply and Being Deeply Seen, 2023, locates soft skills in a list of small, concrete social actions. Disagreeing without poisoning the relationship, revealing vulnerability at the appropriate pace, being a good listener, knowing how to end a conversation gracefully, knowing how to ask for and offer forgiveness, knowing how to let someone down without breaking their heart, knowing how to sit with someone who is suffering, knowing how to host a gathering where everyone feels embraced. Ultimately, Brooks contends that it's largely a matter of effort. When another person is talking, you want to be listening so actively that you're practically burning calories. When I mention soft skills to the occasional corporate leaders I meet through my research, they look grave. They tell me how crucial soft skills are and how hard it is to find them in job candidates, as though they were an elusive species of bird being hunted to death. Yet, when I ask what they are or how they're measured, no one can quite tell me. Researchers note that it's hard to slot soft skills alongside the more rigorous conceptions we have of skill, a category once used to rank industrial workers on the basis of what kinds of machines they knew how to use. When I do encounter real social grace, it doesn't seem like a matter of technical mastery, inherited privilege, or even virtuosity. It instead feels like a rare gift of real responsiveness. It offers a tiny glimpse of the sublime experience of brushing up against another person's subjectivity. Whatever the nature of soft skills, managers are told that the stakes are high. If you are not an active champion of high-priority soft skills behaviors in your sphere of influence and authority, then you can be sure that the talent in your midst will not buy in, wrote the management trainer Bruce Tulkin in Psychology Today. In 2015, McDonald's commissioned a report entitled The Value of Soft Skills to the UK Economy, which claimed that soft skills contributed more than £88 billion to the UK economy, of which fast food restaurants are a major part, underpinning about 6.5% of it, and predicted that 2025 would see 1.78 million unfilled vacancies due to soft skills shortages. It's unclear how exactly the analysts arrive at such precise numbers, but studies like this are in part what has made the soft skills training market worth more than $20 billion in the United States alone. The soft skills industry has come a long way from 1936, when Carnegie published How to Win Friends and Influence People, which offered a set of cheat codes for both intimate and professional relationships. Personality was becoming increasingly impersonal, something you might obtain from a book. Carnegie's ideas were a mishmash of earlier writers' claims and descended from the Victorian cult of character, but he had a unique knack for packaging them for the modern reader, codifying human relationships into a set of universal instructions. He was selling a toolkit that anyone, even those not destined from birth for the Ivy League, could put to use. If one intends to wear the captain's cap and navigate the ship of business, he wrote, personality and the ability to talk are more important than a knowledge of Latin verbs or a sheepskin from Harvard. Carnegie's first order of business was to sow the seeds of soft skills fanaticism, advising students to say to yourself over and over, my popularity, my happiness, and my income depend to no small extent upon my skill in dealing with people. A couple of years later, in a volume called Management and the Worker, the management theorist Fritz Roethlisberger and the personnel expert William Dixon argued that the personnel specialist himself is indeed a type of skilled worker, even if he lacked the technical knowledge of an engineer. Roethlisberger and Dixon were associated with the Human Relations School, a cadre of management scientists in and around Harvard Business School who largely rejected the cold brutality of Taylorism, which optimized time and motion in production. Instead, they reasoned, good managers could create loyal, productive employees by making the workplace emotionally fulfilling. Seen through this lens, the personnel specialist skills in diagnosing any human situation and securing cooperation from workers were valuable, capable of being refined and taught and communicated to others. At a time when labor organizing was especially menacing to bosses, early ancestors of today's soft skills were meant to smooth over workplace frictions, gliding past class conflict. Then, during World War II, the public went to work building war machines. Researchers had come to understand these employees as akin to the very weapons they constructed, capable of being engineered more or less efficiently. By the mid-50s, the phrase soft skills was cropping up in Army literature. For military leadership, soft skills came to represent everything that wasn't measurable in a soldier. It was easy to determine whether someone could shoot a target. It was far more difficult to determine a particular cadet's effect on morale. Those job functions about which we know a good deal are hard skills, and those about which we know very little are soft skills, wrote Paul G. Whitmore, a representative of a human resources research group, in a 1972 paper for a conference the Army held on soft skills, as if the findings exposed a blind spot where supervision failed. In the wake of the anti-war protests of the 60s, Army leadership must have felt as though it had lost control. Soft skills research could let officers bask in the fantasy of measuring and managing what eluded them, human behavior. Whitmore notes the lack of an unequivocal theory of operation for people. Army researchers had such difficulty making meaning from their data that Whitmore quipped that the domain of soft skills was an area fraught with the vagaries of ill-defined terms, which must be hacked through with a semantic machete. Several months after the conference, the United States withdrew its forces from Vietnam, and the Arab oil embargo and the recession that followed fast-tracked deindustrialization. As companies tried to weather the ensuing economic storm of the 70s, jobs became more flexible, which often meant fewer constraints on managers and less security for employees who had to be adaptable. skills were turned into the equivalent of Boy Scout merit badges, talismans of employability, operating as the property of the individual who then carried them luggage-like from job to job, as the employment scholar Jonathan Payne has put it. In a precarious state, workers needed to transform themselves into value-creating entrepreneurs, writes the historian Eric Baker in Make Your Own Job. Soft skills rhetoric took root at Chrysler and Coca-Cola alike, making employees responsible for keeping up as traditional jobs began to devolve into gig work. As the pace of work became more frantic, one could even claim that pressure management skills were being acquired, Payne writes. He narrates how, beginning in 1979, the United Kingdom convened vocational training courses in transferable competencies, often for the unemployed, devoting resources to building so-called skills such as flexibility of attitude and willingness to learn, preparing people to be shunted around by the freer and freer market. Meanwhile, as the term soft skills crept into the 70s and 80s workplace vocabulary, women streamed into the workforce. The soft skills paradigm seemed to accord with women's stereotypical strengths, helping them to eventually worm their way into the C-suite, as though the skills were a kind of feminist panacea. By the 90s, the phrase was no longer confined to the ARCO of consulting, as the New York Times had put it in 1988, but was part of everyday household language. By the turn of the millennium, soft skills represented a kind of scientific management of the soul. Managers felt as if they had discovered that human personalities were reservoirs of untapped value. Corporations scrutinized the subtleties of interpersonal dynamics for waste and profit. By developing soft skills, an employee could make something out of nothing, magically rescuing efficiency from the hazy realm of feelings and relationships. In this view, the word skill prefers hope by implying a learning curve, but it also turns social interaction into an exam. Every meaningful conversation is made up of countless small choices, writes Charles Duhigg in Super Communicators, How to Unlock the Secret Language of Connection. There are fleeting moments when the right question, or a vulnerable admission, or an empathetic word can completely change a dialogue. Here, failure can mean anything from a boring interaction to a life of solitude and possibly unemployment. Unfortunately, soft skills are no silver bullet. One paper from 2005 argued that the concept's feminist bona fides have created a glass cliff in the C-suite, with women executives brought in to lead during crises. They are perceived as having the soft skills needed to navigate difficult situations, as a Times article put it last July, only to plummet when the company fails. Regarding race and class, soft skills may be yet another way to turn biased social judgments into objective measures of ability, as the social scientists Philip Moss and Chris Tilley argued as early as 1996. In a 2024 paper in Applied Economics, a group of researchers found that soft skills have an insignificant effect on job mobility. High scores on communication skills, time management, and low task repetitiveness had a mixed effect on wages and did not make employees more likely to get promoted. But no matter how little quantitative evidence we have that soft skills training helps employees, employers still preach soft skills as the key to individual success. If you're emotionally dysregulated, if your boss resents you, or if you lose your job, it's your fault for being unskilled. Our current soft skills panic, however, is not merely a vintage tactic of oppression from the 70s, but also a folk remedy for distinctly contemporary social problems. While often described as an after effect of the pandemic, the crisis is also forward-looking, aided by McKinsey's claim that soft skills will make business future-proof, as if sealing them against the biblical floods to come. For some, that future holds the prospect of being replaced. Entering the workforce during the pandemic, manager's fear left young workers unable to appreciate their coworkers' humanity, leaving them liable to screw over others in the name of self-care and quiet quitting, a sharp contrast to the purported workaholism of millennials in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis. Growing up during the pandemic, the story goes, this new generation experienced other humans as clusters of pixels safely confined to a two-dimensional plane. Elder bosses may fantasize that teaching 21-year-old business majors a prior age's social norms will make the future not only more recognizable, but one in which their expertise is needed, and the youth have something left to learn. The cult of soft skills also compensates for the shifting global balance of power. One 2024 study shows that China and Russia have far fewer research publications on soft skills than the United States and countries in Europe. Is China creating a workforce with no soft skills? Asked the British Council, an organization characterized as a soft power extension of UK foreign policy, in 2015. The West's sense of itself as the bastion of soft skills is a veiled recapitulation of racist characterizations of Chinese citizens as robots and portrayals of citizens of communist states as automatons. The same stereotypes lurking behind the preoccupation with character, that elusive ingredient of college admissions that evaluators have been accused of using to reject Asian applicants. Some researchers associate the surge in demand for soft skills with the coming of Industry 5.0, as the European Commission named an approach to the world of AI, which demands collaboration between humans and machines, and an era that will be marked by diminished interpersonal interactions resulting from the pervasive impact of the COVID-19 pandemic, as one team of management scientists put it. After all, the thing that makes us indispensably human, non-redundant to the machines we create, is our ability to thoughtfully interact with one another. What do we have that robots don't? Feelings, at least for now. In Tokyo, a team of scientists is teaching pink robotic gel made of human skin flesh to flash a very disturbing smile. In an increasingly unpredictable environment, soft skills can encourage a fantasy of boundless adaptability. People and organizations will be able to adjust to anything that could possibly happen. Organizations are advised to cultivate nimble and adaptable skills at scale and maintain skills agility, continually reworking the competencies of their workers. Adaptability, of course, being itself a soft skill. Recent articles prize shape-shifting as a competency in its own right, an underlying skill of sorts, and hold out hope that our species can keep up with the world we've created. Everyone should be reskilling and upskilling all the time, whether they are doing day-long etiquette courses, micro-learning, or nano-learning, short bursts of instruction to help people make progress in small bites, as LinkedIn puts it. Employees should be like the ship of Theseus, comprised of endlessly interchangeable components. But even as soft skills claim to be a solution to automation, they also help you automate yourself, reducing human interaction to an arsenal of techniques programmed into the mind. Soft skills will apparently rescue us from redundancy, even as they render human interaction a little more mechanical. Oddly, the crisis is not about how we will operate or control machines, it's about how we will operate and control one another. This dynamic reveals a vulnerability in which an obsession with skills could, in fact, feed into AI optimism rather than act as protection from encroaching technology, happily offloading monotonous and unpleasant activities to the robots, as a team of business scientists in the Netherlands describes. We risk spending most of our time dissecting one another's personalities. Productivity will hinge on interaction efficiency and a person's emotional IQ. They claim that this process optimizes our brains for machines to use us. Soft skills will enable artificial intelligence and robots to use human brain capacity and creativity to boost process efficiency. The researchers adopt a celebratory tone. You are listening to the essay, Going Soft, Future-Proofing the American Worker, by Lily Sherless, from the April issue of Harper's Magazine on SunSounds of Arizona. As socioeconomic and ideological gaps widen in the United States, people will continue to find one another inscrutable, infuriating, or hostile, however much everyone softens themselves. In this light, soft skills can be seen as a workplace corollary to centrist pleas for a right wing that doesn't storm the Capitol and a left that doesn't take up space on the campus lawn. In turn, the demand to manage conflict agreeably seems a little asinine when powerful people have few incentives to listen to the disempowered's requests, however charming they may be expressed. While employers were fantasizing about harmonious organizations, Elon Musk began gutting entire federal agencies. Musk once talked a big game about soft-skilled leadership. The supervisor is there to serve his team, not the other way around, he told Tesla employees in 2017. But after buying Twitter in 2022, Musk led employees to his first fork in the road, giving them one day to decide whether to become extremely hardcore or quit. One needs soft skills, it turns out, only when one needs things from other people. With their bunkers and independent electrical grids, today's true elites don't think they need society at all. Musk's Department of Government Efficiency invokes the same credo of optimization that gave us soft skills in the first place. Austerity and soft skills play bad cop and good cop, and both come with countervailing extravagances, tax cuts and training courses, respectively. But they're part of the same logic of bad social engineering. Trump's plan to clean out the deep state will leave massive personnel gaps in government agencies that cannot be bridged by mere effective communication, and certainly not by the characters he's putting in charge, who seem exempt from the soft skills mandate. The United States is maturing into a cult of ability in which current leaders explicitly prefer survival of the fittest to inclusivity, let alone collectivity. The historian Quinn Slobodian has compared the new administration's vision of society to one of its favorite sports competitions, the Ultimate Fighting Championship. The quieter flip side of the overt evil of social Darwinism is that none of us are ever capable enough. Bottomless inadequacy organizes our experience in almost imperceptible ways, as when human connection becomes a matter of competence, spawning a culture of socially anxious people so worried about whether they are doing a good job cultivating relationships that they choose chatbots over social events. To feel better about our deficiencies, the relatively able among us trained for super communication and ultra marathons alike. People are saying, like, dude, I gotta get that edge, Andre, the instructor, told me, explaining what people want from the Dale Carnegie course. I have to be distinguishable. I have to come up with a new idea. I have to manage the change cycle. I started to think that improving workers' soft skills is partly a way to sustain a narrative of social progress at a moment when it would be generous to say we're running in place. AI will make jobs kind of pointless, Musk said at the World Artificial Intelligence Conference in 2019. Unfortunately, some people will still have to do them. AI will simply make their jobs even more annoying. Duhigg praises the way some call centers use AI to act as a kind of soft skills dramaturge, directing customer service representatives in real time as they adjust their tone to match a caller's. In this case, it's the managers who risk becoming obsolete. Meanwhile, the domain of the crisis of soft skills rarely includes the workplaces where personality is being put to the hardest test, the home, the care industry, and the service industry, where automation is unlikely to make a real dent, at least not until the pink robotic gel that smiles grows arms and legs and something like a heart. As the scholar Jason E. Smith has argued, low-skilled labor now means work involving people, such as taking care of members of an aging population, delivering takeout, or customer service, work that may require more intensive emotional self-management than C-suite jobs. Service workers have long been paid to mask their real feelings behind a veneer of conviviality in order to, as the sociologist Arlie Hochschild wrote in 1983, produce an emotional state in another person. It turns out that if you spend all day pretending to have some feelings and not others, the divide between the personal and the professional tends to break down. You may wind up confused about which emotions are actually yours. This explains why I felt so vacant after each long day of practicing Carnegie's principles, prone to staring into the middle distance when among friends. By the third morning, I knew which participants were available for surreptitious eye contact when the density of buzzwords spiked. The magic formula. I don't know how I can use it in my profession, said one such classmate. We had spent the morning learning a formula for a lively 2-minute motivational presentation that influences action. It involved a simple equation: evidence plus action plus benefit equals desirable actions and results. We were advised to sprinkle in a little thing that we call magic. One person gave a 2-minute speech on the importance of smiling. What do you do? Andre asked the woman. He looked slightly stumped, considering the idea that anyone in the room would have a job that did not require persuading other people to work harder. I'm a dentist. In that moment, it struck me that if soft skills do exist, they may come into play most urgently when you're drilling a hole into a child's tooth, more so than when you're managing subordinates. As the population ages, mass quantities of skills will indeed be needed, most of all by people getting paid below minimum wage to empty bedpans, make small talk with the ailing, and manage their pain. So maybe there is a crisis in the supply of soft skills. It's just not where we think it is. Lily Sherless is a writer and a PhD candidate at the University of Chicago. Up next, A Manner of Squeaking, Translating the Emotional Lives of Rats, by Laura Maris. In 2017, the neuroscience researchers Kevin Coffey and Ruby Marks were analyzing rodent chatter in a lab at the University of Washington. Making rat communication legible to human beings is a laborious undertaking. Researchers must record the rats' ultrasonic calls with specialized microphones, convert the resulting audio into spectrograms, and then recognize types of calls by sight, a process that can take hundreds of hours over the course of a single study. Coffey and Marks wanted to speed things up. Borrowing an algorithm designed for self-driving cars, the pair developed a program they dubbed Deep Squeak. The program, which uses similarities in frequency, shape, and duration to sort like calls into different color-coded clusters, works 10 times faster than real-time and creates images, a vivid collection of rat sounds that resembles a fireworks display. Researchers then study the behavior rats exhibit while emitting the calls to identify what they might be communicating. Since its advent, Deep Squeak has helped researchers isolate what it sounds like when rats express joy, alarm, and excitement, as well as more complex social calls they have yet to fully decipher. Dark green calls are a subtype of trill, sometimes associated with anticipation, the call a rat might make when it expects a positive social interaction. The pink calls are also trills, a sound the neuroscientist Jake Panzep was the first to compare to human laughter. In the late 90s, he and his colleagues at Bowling Green State University noticed that adolescent rats made particular 50 kilohertz sounds while playing together, and the same sounds when lab researchers tickled them. These calls, Panzep concluded, served a similar social function as laughter for humans. He went on to theorize that the neural structures activated in roughhousing rats could help us understand the development of joyful vocalizations in human children, arguing that laughter might be a primal indicator of playfulness shared across species. Penncep's work was foundational for the study of rat communication. He established that rat calls were neither random nor merely a byproduct of rats' movement, as earlier theories had posited. Since then, the neuroscientists Jennifer Wright, Candace Burke, and Penncep's collaborator Jeffrey Bergdorf have studied how positive rodent calls correspond to specific behaviors, such as wrestling, chasing, and exploring. Penncep's work has also reached artists like Kathy High, a professor at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, who has played Bergdorf's original tickle recordings for retired lab rats. With her technologists, High has transposed rat laughter into human hearing range, where it sounds like cooing, atonal music, part howl, part question mark. Besides enabling researchers to work much faster, Deep Squeak has also helped reveal that rat communication is more nuanced than previously assumed. We still don't know exactly how many kinds of rat calls exist. Some trilly shapes are trickier to categorize than others, but in 2010, Wright's visual inspection of 20,000 spectrograms found 14 distinct call types. Using Deep Squeak, Coffey and Marks have estimated that there are 18. Burke has found tight links between varied trills like the purple ones and moments of play fighting, such as when a rat prepares to pounce on the nape of a companion. She believes these subtypes may allow one rat to inform another when to switch roles while playing. At the Medical University of South Carolina, Stuart Cox has used Deep Squeak to study the role of calls in fostering empathetic behavior among rats. He has found that a rat in distress will emit a mix of positive and alarm calls to secure the aid of another rat, rather than just using calls of panic. But it's not only the researchers studying rats who have benefited from the software. Deep Squeak has also successfully classified the communication patterns of the gray mouse lemur, and shown promise for identifying calls of some marine mammals. Despite the strides scientists have made using Deep Squeak, there are a host of challenges to mapping out the full range of rodent speech. Since developing the software, Coffey has learned that rat calls smear into one another, making it difficult to isolate discrete units of meaning. Some calls last just a few milliseconds, and the significance of certain longer ones can still evade researchers. The red calls, for example, have proven harder to decipher, partly because we don't have enough behavioral context for their use. Researchers doing this kind of human-animal translation work also have to transcend their own conceptual sense of language and figure out how non-human vocalizations fit within the larger, stranger realm of animal communication. All the patterns, smells, and gestures that we don't intuitively think of as messages, but whose nuances animals perceive and comprehend, like when bees waggle their abdomens and dance in figure eights to indicate the location of resources to other members of their hive, or when a marlin hunting in a group rapidly brightens its stripes to signal that it's going in for an attack. Deep Squeak has helped Coffey track how rats in his lab respond to changes in their surroundings, such as the noise introduced by a nearby construction project. Through vocalizations, researchers have gotten closer to understanding the evolution of a rat's inner world, but it's possible that there are subtleties we'll never think to notice and nuances that will always remain a mystery. For as long as we've lived alongside them, rats have been feared for their associations with disease, and since at least the medieval period, there have been people who earn a living exterminating them. The legendary Pied Piper of Hamelin was a rat catcher who played shrill, squeaking sounds on his pipe, luring all the rats in the city into a nearby body of water where they drowned. In Victorian England, rat catchers went house to house offering their services, sometimes with rats up their sleeves as proof they understood the wiles of their quarry and how to trap them. More recently, researchers found that playing lab rats' distress calls, which appear long and flat, pictured blue in the study, can sometimes cause them to avoid a specific area or spend more time in hiding. There's now a robust market for devices claiming to repel rodents with ultrasonic frequencies that mimic the sound of their alarm calls. One device for sale on Amazon promises to broadcast pulse waves in the 22 to 36 kHz range, making your space inhospitable. But as yet, there's little evidence that these strategies work in the long term. When Coffey played recorded alarm calls in his lab, he noticed that the rats weren't fooled. "We've had experiences where it almost seems obvious that they know it's not another animal," he told me. "The speakers can't quite do the ultrasounds the way they can." Even as we deepen our knowledge of rat communication, it still might be a while before we can truly squeak back. Laura Maris is a writer and translator. She is the author most recently of The Age of Loneliness, which was published in August by Grey Wolf Press. Now I'll be reading Homefront from interviews given to a researcher by six Ukrainian women in May and June of last year and provided to Harper's Magazine. The researcher's identity has been withheld to protect the women's safety. 1. I'm from Kharkiv, a big industrial center in eastern Ukraine. It had been transformed in recent years, before the war. That means good roads, flower beds, lovely parks. It's beautiful. It hurts me to know that missiles land in different parts of the city and people die. The people of Kharkiv are very tired. They've lived through war for more than 2 years. Kharkiv has filled up with people who came from small towns that were right in the line of military action. We are very close to the stations that launch missiles. So sometimes the missiles arrive first, and only then does the siren go off. No one pays attention to it anymore. People sitting in cafes keep on sitting there. People going to work keep on going to work. It is not normal for an ordinary person not to fear an explosion. People should live in peace, should develop, should go to work, should produce some products, should rest, should bring up children. Many of our children do not go to school because there are so many destroyed schools. In addition, it is scary to send a child to school. There are only a few schools that have good bomb shelters where children study. They have even set up classrooms in the metro. Inside the subway, the passageway from one station to another is now taken up with desks. It's mostly older people, women, and children who ride the metro. There are very few men. It is very rare to meet a man of draft age. Recruiters go around all the places where you can meet people, handing out notices, markets, stores, parking lots, parks, subways, buses, bus stations. These are all places where they can hand you a draft notice. Men are in the most powerless position because the only thing they are allowed to do is to go to war. 2. My friend sent me a photograph showing a vehicle belonging to the Army Recruitment Division stopping cars and dragging out the men and taking them away. This is done by force. We call it stealing people. Women try to beat them back. Mothers come to the enlistment center to get their sons. They make scenes. They fight. It's led to such consequences, attacking the military personnel who are defending us, thinking that they work for the enlistment centers. There are horrible things. I know of a situation in which a student was asked by his teacher to come in earlier. This boy was always late. He was always getting yelled at. But this time his mother got him organized and said, "Go, At least you'll be on time for once. He went. They took him to war, and he was dead a week later. I don't think it will happen in the big cities, but it happens in the small towns because they are less able to stand up for themselves. They are more subordinate to the authority of men in uniforms than city dwellers. The trouble is that some small towns already have no men left, and they have very many cemeteries, and the cemeteries are full. 3. We visited schools near the front line. In those areas where the line went right through a town, we had to go with the children because they were afraid to go to school. They were afraid of the military, afraid of the airstrikes. We simply talked with the little kids. One time, we arrived at a school, and the head teacher, who loved us and always waited for us to come and talk with the kids, was in a very bad psychological state herself. We talked with her and learned what was wrong. The day before, there was a big airstrike in the center of the town, and they saw it hit a house. She and her husband ran over to see if anyone was alive in the house, if they could help. As she was running, something squished under her foot. She shone her flashlight on it and saw that she had run atop the remains of her old schoolmate. One minute she had been talking with friends, and the next she ran over the body of a friend she had known since childhood and had just been talking to. Just the thought was horrifying. This woman came to the school the next day to help us organize help for the children, but who was there to help her? 4. If there is a man at war in a family, that adds a burden on women. Every day is filled with fear that there will be bad news. They live under regular air raids and experience extreme emotional tension, fear, and trauma. I often think about how women will have to restore Ukraine because we are losing men. But women are so exhausted now that they may not have the strength. Of course, there are also women whose men are not fighting. They hide these men at home, afraid they will be drafted. The social roles change. Before, the man was the breadwinner and the woman ran the house. Now, women must go to work. There are cases in which women are forced to have a third child because men with 3 children are not drafted. The war leaves a mark on the behavior and emotional state of people, and violence can appear in families where it had not existed before. Teenagers, especially girls, are more vulnerable, especially in low-income families that live near military bases. 5. There used to be an online map that showed strikes and destruction in Luhansk. One night when I was away, I couldn't sleep, and I kept a tablet under my pillow, on which I kept checking the situation. Suddenly, I saw a strike right next door to my address. I kept trying to call my father and couldn't reach him. For a few days, I thought I would lose my mind. And then my father called. His voice was cheerful. And I said, "Papa, how are you there? What's going on?" He said, "I'm in Petrovsk. That's a village not far from Luhansk." He said that there was so much shelling that it was impossible to stay at home. The house that was hit next door was where a babushka lived. I said, "How is she?" He said she had made some soup and took it over to an ailing neighbor, and that saved her. It was a miracle. 6. War changes people. People who should not have killed and were not born to kill have a completely different view now after the war. I find it very hard to look them in the eye. I want to go back to the life I had before, but it's not like that, and it will never be like that again, so I don't know. Yesterday, my friend asked me what my plans are for the next couple of years, and I realized that I don't know how to make plans. It's enough for me that I have a plan at least for a week, for a month. This is the distance in time that I can control, I can keep, and I can manage, because everything beyond that is hard to predict. I have acquaintances who are still filled with hope, but I think my only hope is that we do not die of hatred. Time now for a poem, Plates of Fruit Cut and Peeled, by David Sung from Silkworm's Pansori, which was published last month by The Song Cave. Persimmons on a leafless tree, unlaid eggs in a butchered hen. The old woman picks from the sagging branch. The grandson skips a stone. It rejects the pond three times, as if it belonged on that far shore. I'll conclude today with Speech Pathology from Pathemata, or The Story of My Mouth by Maggie Nelson, which will be published this month by Wave Books. In speech therapy, we played a board game in which to advance, you had to say a tongue twister slowly and clearly. The imperative to slow down, combined with my tongue's whimpering confusion each time it encountered the metal prick, produced in me a fear and fantasy that one day my tongue would simply rip free of its vassalage like the black stallion cut loose to eat seaweed and run on the beach with traumatized freckled Alec. Unspeared, it would produce such extraordinary speech that it wouldn't matter anymore if the multitude could understand me. I would echolocate, and in time a tribe of like-tongued people, the humpers, the thrusters, would advance over the summit, leather-clad, to recover me. Thanks so much for joining me today for this hour of Harper's Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Today's readings have been from the April 2025 issue. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Ellen Ward, saying goodbye for now and looking forward to reading with you again next time.